Tonight, we want to conclude our discussion together about the allurement of sin. We have tried to look at this particular subject by a biblical perspective of defining what sin is, defining how it's used, defining how Satan uses it as an advantage to gain an advantage over us. And this morning we talked about the character of the one who is our adversary. Tonight we want to look at concluding this particular section of Genesis and looking at sin by the biblical definitions that we find in other passages. One of the questions I've often been asked, and maybe you have too, is why Eve gave in? Why did she yield to Satan? What could have entered her mind to give up or to not believe God when God had given her everything that she knew? Everything that she knew, everything she had, God was the source of it. She had life because God created her from the rib of Adam. She had a home. She had being in the Garden of Eden. She had a husband, and they had dominion over everything God created. They were with God. They had fellowship with God. And not only that, there was no sickness, no disease, no death. There was not anything in the beginning that was negative. Not one thing. And yet, Eve put it all at risk when she was tempted by Satan to counteract and disobey what God said. Now, since I don't know the mind of Eve, I really can't tell you why. But I think the scripture gives us some insight as into why. And the same reason she fell and the same reason Adam fell is the same reason why people give in to Satan today. And so we begin with, why did Eve fall? What mistake did she make? Well, the mistake that Eve made is in Genesis 3 and in verse number 6. This is the mistake that Eve made. It says, so when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. Now, you remember in the beginning that when she fell and when they sinned, you remember that she tried to pass the blame, and so did Adam. Adam tried to pass it on to Eve, and Eve and Adam, in essence, blamed God because God was the one that gave him Eve. And then Eve tried to blame the serpent. So each of them tried to run from their accountability, but we know that in God's infinite wisdom, he punished all three. In the sins and the punishment of those sins, he punished the man, the woman, and the serpent. All three were punished if you read the account beginning in verse number 12 to the end of the chapter. So all three of them were punished because all three were guilty. But in this verse is the reason that Eve yielded in sin, and is the same reason why we sin. Because the avenue of sin is found in this verse. In this verse is the avenue that sin takes in every one of our lives. It goes down one of these three roads. I want you to notice, first of all, that why did Eve fall? Because she was lied to. Did the devil lie to her? Yes. Did he tell her some truth? Yes, he did. He told her a partial truth. Would she know the difference between right and wrong? Would she be able to discern from right and wrong? Yes, she'd be able to do that. But would she be like God? No, she would not be like God. And he lied to her because he said, you will not die. And so he lied to her on three fronts. She would die, and it would be disobedience. And yes, she would know the difference between good and evil, but Satan hid from her what that would mean, what that would bring into her life, what that would bring into mankind, What would that cost? What chain would that begin? What chain reaction would her disobedience put in motion? Do you realize when she sinned, it put God's plan into motion? When she yielded and Adam yielded, it put God's plan into motion. Because now man's going to be separated from God. Now man's going to be alienated from God. Now man's going to be an enemy of God. And now the fellowship is going to be broken. Because what did God say? In the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. And that happened in Genesis 3:24. They were thrown out of the Garden of Eden. They were separated from God. And now you have a chasm between man and God. God and man are now alienated. Why? Because of sin. Now I would suggest to you today that no way did Adam and Eve understand that when they made that decision, that was what was going to happen. Now God told them. God told them what would happen. And that should have been enough. And ladies and gentlemen, that should always be enough. When God says that something bad can happen if you pursue this course, that should be enough. We shouldn't have to have any redefining. We shouldn't have any clarification. When God says that this is not the wise course for you to pursue, that ought to be enough. But unfortunately with man, that's never enough because he wants more information. So was she lied to? Yes. But that did not absolve her from her guilt. Even though she was lied to, even though he misled her, he deceived her, all that did not take away her guilt. She still was guilty. Number two, did he force her to do it? No, he didn't force her to do it. He didn't put a gun to her head. He didn't twist her arm. He didn't threaten her in any way. Go back and read the account. There was nothing forced on Eve. He just said, you won't die and you'll be like God. That's all that he said. He didn't do anything else. And so he wasn't forced to sin. But why did she fall? Her downfall stemmed from something within her. She fell because of something that was within Eve. Something that came from Eve. Something that came from Adam. Not something that came from God. Not something that came from an outside force. She fell because of something that was in her. Please take your Bible out and turn to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. I'm going to read verse 9 and 10. I struggled with this verse, and I've told you in the past for many, many years, trying to reconcile this passage with God's declaration in other passages that his desire is that all men be saved. And again, that is God's desire. 2 Peter 3:9 teaches that. 1 Timothy 2 verse 4 teaches that his desire is that all men be saved. He did not create man. This is one of the atheist arguments. This is one of the atheists that he says, well, God wouldn't create man to destroy him. And the atheist on that point's right. God didn't create man to destroy him. That wasn't what he planned to do. That's not what he ever wanted to do. But when man sinned, then he caused that to be a possibility. But in 2 Thessalonians, in verse chapter 2, beginning in verse 9, it says, the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders. Now the lawless one is the one that opposes God. Anyone that opposes God, whether it's a false teacher, a false prophet, whether somebody that transforms himself into something he's not, that's a lawless one. That's one that's acting without authority. And whoever that is a messenger of Satan. It doesn't matter what his reason is. It doesn't matter what his desire is. He is the lawless one. He is the one that's being talked about here. And he's going to work with all power, signs, and lying wonders. Now, lying wonder just means they're deception. They're not real. They're something that's not what it appears to be. But the bigger problem is in verse 10. And this is why Eve fell, and this is why men fall today. With all unrighteousness, deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. People fall into sin because they don't have a love for the truth. All right, what does that mean? Yeah, you don't have a love for the truth. That means you don't accept God's answer. or you don't know God's answer. Both of them are your responsibility. It is our responsibility to know what God's answer is, and it's our responsibility to follow God's instruction. But if you don't love the truth, if you don't love the truth enough to trust God, to believe God, to do what God says, then you will be deceived. You will be misled, and you will make the wrong choice. And so it is something that comes from within man, something that tings at him that he believes in himself more than he trusts God. Now, we're supposed to trust God more, but there's a tendency that we put too much faith in ourselves, or we might put too much faith in other people. And that's what Eve did. Eve put too much faith in the serpent. Why would the serpent tell her the truth? What good thing did the serpent do? What good thing had he done for her? Nothing. He hadn't done anything for her. So she misplaced her trust. She misplaced her love, and when she misplaced her love, it caused doubt, and she had desires that were contrary to God. Now, you know who else helped us understand this? James. In James 1, in verse 14 and 15, here is how sin works. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. You see, we sin because we're drawn away by our own desires. We are not concerned with God's will. We're concerned with what we want. Now, let me ask you a simple question. Does it work the same in every one of us? The answer is no. Because, you know, my desire may be different than your desire. What you may be weak in, something that you might be have a tendency to fall and be weak in, is not the same as what maybe mine is. But here's two things that you need to know. Two people know that. Well, really, three people know that. God knows it, of course. But there's two other people that know that. One is you, and the other one is your adversary. He knows what your weakness is. And he's going to use your weakness in order to trip you up, to entice you. That is to tempt you. That is to put something in front of you that's appealing to you. Now, let me give you an illustration. When I worked and labored in Las Vegas for 13 years, I mean, gambling, I mean, it was everywhere. I mean, you couldn't go to a 7-Eleven. You couldn't go to a gas station that there wouldn't be slot machines there. You couldn't go to the grocery store. You couldn't go to Kmart. You couldn't go anywhere that there wasn't a place. You couldn't, when you fly into the airport, if you ever fly into Las Vegas, you know the first thing you're going to see when you come out of the airport, when you get off the runway and you step in the airport, the first thing you're going to see as you step on the carpet, you're going to see a row of slot machines all the way around where you get off the plane. When I first arrived there, they had a blackjack table down in the baggage claim. They had to get it out because they couldn't get the people out of there because they were playing blackjack. Now, do you think they did that by accident? No, they didn't do that by accident. And if you go to a hotel and you stay in the hotel, they're going to give you a free roll of quarters. I wonder why they do that. I know why they do that. They want you to put them in the machine. You see, it's not, you're not gambling. It's their money. You're not going to lose anything till you lose those $10 of quarters. You see, that's an enticement. That's an enticement. But you know what? That was no enticement to me. That was none. I never was tempted on that level to gamble. For one reason, I worked too hard for my money just to put it in a machine or lay it down on the table and give it to some guy who's gonna put it in his pocket. I worked too hard to do that, so that was an enticement to me. But I can tell you horror stories about many people who that was an enticement to. There was a young man that we had attended in the first place that I attended. He was in the military. He worked in the finance department. He would embezzle money by shifting it around because he had access to the computer, and he would take money that was extra money that was paid, like I worked at a site. And anybody that worked at a site, you got extra pay because you had to buy, you didn't wear your uniform, you wore clothing so you can mix in with the, you can mix in with the people you work with. They didn't know who was military and who wasn't. And so we got our housing, we got a clothing allowance. Well, he got in there and he began to move that money around, in the essence to put it out of this account and take a few dollars, $20, $30, $40, $50 from maybe 10, 15 different accounts and put it in his account. Now, why was he doing that? To cover his gambling losses. You know what happened to that young man? Of course, he was caught. And when he was caught, he was sent to Leavenworth for 20 years because he couldn't say no to gambling. I was in a meeting with the elders some years later where we had a man that was 40 years old, and he couldn't walk by a machine. He could, if he walked by a machine, it's like it's talking to him. It's telling him to go in there and put his money in there. He just couldn't say no. You know what the elders told him? You need to move. And you need to move very quickly. Because if you don't, you're going to destroy yourself. You know, sometimes people have enticement, but it's something that's within them. Just like an alcoholic. You know, if you're a recovering alcoholic, you're always a recovering alcoholic. You always are one step away. I'll give you another illustration. The young man who's a very good friend of mine, he had a very sordid back past. He was real worldly in every way, drinking, drugs, immorality. I mean, he could write a book. Today he's a gospel preacher. I won't tell you who he is, but he would tell you he's not ashamed of his past. He's glad God gave him time to correct it. But you know, to this day, I've been out with him in preaching in other places. And to this day, if we're walking down a street and there's a bar on this side of the street, he's walking on the other side of the street. He's not even going to get close to it because he's afraid that it would lure him back in. He's afraid that he could be tempted to go in there, so he doesn't even get near it. You know what? That's wisdom. That's wisdom. And you know what? Who knows you better than you? If you know you're weak in an area, then you need to be careful. And you need to not put yourself in that area, because if you do, Satan is going to entice you, he's going to tempt you, and he's going to try to get you to fall. And when you do, you can't blame God. And you can't blame Satan, because you are the one that has the weakness. Now, here's where people get it messed up. You don't have this weakness because you're a man or because you're human. You have this weakness because of something that's within you. Why do some men have weakness for some things and other men don't? Because we're different. Because we have different enticements. We have different desires. And so everybody's not tempted in the same way, but everybody's going to be tempted. But what did God promise about temptation? He said, with every temptation, he will make a way that you're able to escape it. And he will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with every temptation, make a way of escape that you might be able to bear. Now, does God lie to us? God doesn't lie to us. That's 1 Corinthians 10:13. Now, if man falls and he has a weakness, that doesn't mean God tempted him beyond what he was able. Because with that temptation, God made a way out. But if you don't take the way out, whose fault is that? That's your fault. And so Eve fell because she was misplaced her love. Because it made let doubt creep in. And doubt creeped in, and then her desires came into play. And then she gave in to her desires, and it caused her to sin. Now, what was Eve's enticement? How did he entice Eve? The way he enticed Eve is how Satan entices us. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. In 1 John chapter 2, it talks about this. It says, for all that is in the world is the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. This is not of the Father, but of the world. Every avenue of sin, every sin, no matter what sin you're talking about, goes down one of these three roads. It's either lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, or the pride of life. Every sin falls into one of these three categories. You will not be tempted in any other way except these three ways. Every way you can be enticed, every way you can be tempted, goes down one of these three avenues. Now, let's just talk about them very briefly. Lust of the flesh. Good for food. You see, it was good for food. She saw it, and do people get hungry? That's a fleshly appetite. We get hungry, that's a fleshly appetite. And so he appealed to her fleshly appetite. And she saw it, and she had this flesh. She's hungry, and she looked at the tree, and it looked like it was good for food, so that enticed her to satisfy that hunger. Now, is it wrong to be hungry? Or if it is, we're in trouble. I'm in trouble. It's not wrong to be hungry. It's not wrong to be hungry. And it's not sinful to do something to satisfy your hunger, but it is if it causes you to commit sin. Let me give you a biblical example. In Numbers chapter 11, verse 4 through 35, what did Israel do when God brought her out? And she didn't have any food. She began to grumble and complain. And then what did she do? She said, well, we didn't have this problem in Egypt. When we were in Egypt, we had melons and onions and leek, and we had meat to the full, and we had bread to the full, and they began to want to go back. They began to want to go back to how good it was when they were in Egypt. Really? It was good in Egypt? Who cried to God? Who asked God to deliver them? Who said that they were being oppressed and they wanted delivered from God? Who did that? They did that. But you see, their desire was that they wanted to like it the good old days. You ever heard people say that? People talk about the good old days. What is that? The good old days. Well, that's places where you have good memories. Nothing wrong with the good old days, as long as the good old days weren't sinful. In Psalms chapter 78, verse 18, it says, and they tested God in their heart by asking for food of their fancy. See, they tested God. They provoked God because they weren't happy. Remember, they didn't like the manna. After a while, they didn't like the manna. And so they began to complain for the meat. Oh, God heard that. God answered that complaint, didn't he? He gave them quail. If you go back and remember when we read that, the quail were all the way to 4 or 5 feet deep. All the way around the camp. And it says they ate it until they loathed it. For a month, they had nothing but quail until it came out of their nostrils. You see, but they thought that's what they wanted. You see, that's lust of the flesh. And then you have a warning. The warning in Ephesians chapter 2 is that do not let the lust of the flesh tempt you to sin. In Ephesians chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, it says, and he made alive who were dead in trespasses and sin, in which you once walked, according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power in the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom you also once conducted yourself in the lust of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as others. What is the lust of the flesh? Lust of the flesh can be sensual appetites that God placed in man. And it's not unlawful to satisfy them in the lawful way. But when you go beyond the law to do that, then you commit sin. You know, I've had a lot of people in my office over the years that I've been a preacher who fell into adultery or fell in and destroyed their home and their marriages. And all of them make this statement, well, I didn't think it would happen. I didn't go looking for it. It just happened. You know what? It doesn't just happen. It doesn't just happen. You have to make decisions all along the way for it to happen. It doesn't just happen. So God says we need to be careful. In 1 Peter chapter 4, in verse number 2, 1 Peter 4 and verse 2, Peter would write, that we no longer should live for the rest of the time in the flesh for the lust of men, but for the will of God. And then in Galatians 5, it talks about the works of the flesh. The works of the flesh that cause us and lead us into sin. We've got to control those. We've got to say no to those. So what's the remedy? The remedy is in Romans 13, verse 14. How do we protect ourselves? Romans 13 and verse 14, it says, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust. You know what that means? That means do it Christ's way. Put on Christ, do it His way. Satisfy the desires of the flesh lawfully, the way that God gave you to control them, the way that God gave you to satisfy them. But when you are enticed to go contrary to what God says, you've got to say no. You've got to say no. And so, the lust of the flesh, it's a real, real enticement. You've got to say no. And then we have the lust of the eyes. Pleasant to the eyes. She looked on the tree, it not only looked good physically, it looked good for food. It also looked nice. Her eyes, it looked very nice. And so she desired it. She said it was pleasant to the eyes. You remember? Let me give you a biblical example too. Achan. Remember when they took Jericho? God said, now you go in there and don't you take of any of the accursed things because they belong to me. Now I want you to take your Bible and I want you to turn to Joshua chapter 7. I want you to look at Achan's answer when he is confronted with his sin. When he is confronted about what he did, I want you to notice how he explains it. Because this is the lust of the eyes. In Joshua chapter 7, listen to Joshua in verse 19. It says, now Joshua said to Achan, my son, I beg you, give glory to the Lord your God and make confession to him. Tell me now what you have done. Do not hide it from me. Now listen to what Achan says. And Achan answered Joshua and said, indeed I have sinned against the Lord. And this is what I've done. When I saw among the spoils a beautiful Babylonian garment, 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and I took them. And here they are, hidden in the earth, in the midst of my tent, and the silver under it. Notice, I saw a beautiful Babylonian garment. I saw the silver, I saw the gold, and I coveted it. He knew God said no. God said don't take any of that. But it was the lust of the eyes. He saw it, and he wanted it, so he took it. Now what happened to Achan? His family, his wife, his children, and everything he possessed, and even that Babylonian garment and that shekel of silver and gold, they put it in a hole and they put them in it and they were stoned to death, and then God put a heap of stones and covered them as a memorial of their unfaithfulness. Now I've heard people say, that's pretty harsh. What did Achan's action cause to happen? They went to Ai. They were defeated and 36 men died because of one man's greed. Don't tell me it was harsh. God warned them. But you see, he coveted it. Now, here's another example. What about David? In 2 Samuel chapter 11 and 12. Remember David? They're out fighting in the battle. David went out to his roof in the evening. just to get a breath of air. And he goes out there, and lo and behold, across the way, there's a beautiful woman named Bathsheba that's taking a bath. Now, what should David have done? Now, the lust of the eyes, he likes what he sees. But what should he have done? He should have turned around and went back into his palace. But he didn't do that. He stayed out there and began to watch. And then that led to lust. And that led for him to find out who is this woman? Who is she? And then when they told her that she was the wife of Uriah the Hittite, one of his soldiers that were out fighting his battle, while he's out there fighting, he calls for her and sends for her. And she commits adultery. And then word comes back that she's with child. Now he's really got a problem. So what does he do? He brings Uriah back. And he tries to get Uriah to go down to his house and sleep with his wife to cover up his sin. That didn't work. Because, you know, Uriah was an honorable man. And when he went down to his house, he slept on the doorpost. He sat in the front door. He wouldn't go in. And then when they came and told David, he says, Uriah, why did you sleep on the front doorstep of your house? He goes, well, should I go in and be refreshed and lie with my wife where my fellow soldiers and Israel is out in the tents, in the field, fighting the battle? That wouldn't be honorable. I won't do that. What does that tell you about it, Uriah? He had integrity. And then he tried to get him drunk. That didn't work. Then what did he do? He gave Joab a note. He said, you put Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle, and you move away. You know why he did that? So he'd be killed. If you go back and read the account, David's a little angry in the beginning because they pulled back and the archers who were on top of the wall were able to shoot and able to kill him. And he's got, and after the period of mourning's done, then he calls for Bathsheba, makes it his wife, and nobody knows. Oh yes, somebody knew. God knew. And you know what? What happened because of that with David? You know one of the punishments that David was told that he would have? Blood would never be far from his own house. Amnon killed his sister. Amnon was killed by Absalom. Absalom tried to steal the kingdom away from David. The young child that was conceived in that adulterous relationship, 7 days after he was born, he died. Don't hurt nobody, does it? Just me, it doesn't bother anybody else, really. Cause Israel's name to be blasphemed because of the acts of David. You see, but how did it all start? He just stayed out on that roof a little bit too long to allow his eyes to look at something that he should have turned away from. Does God warn us about that? Look at Matthew chapter 5, verse 28. Matthew chapter 5, verse 28. This is the Sermon on the Mount. Here's what God's Son said about this. He said, but I say to you, whoever looks at a woman to lust after her has already committed adultery in his heart. You know, I've heard people say, well, you know, it's okay to look. No, it's not okay to look. If you're married, it's not okay to look. And if you're not married, it's not okay to look. Because it generates lust. And you don't believe that it doesn't generate lust? You know, I've heard people make this argument. Well, you know, if women dressed more modestly, I wouldn't have this problem. You've got the responsibility no matter what the woman does. You have the responsibility to keep your mind straight. And if you have a weakness in this area, then you need to not be in places where you'll be tempted. And I know what somebody's going to tell me. Well, Keith, I wouldn't be able to even go to Walmart. I wouldn't be able to go to Kmart. You know what? There's some truth in that, but you don't have to look. When somebody parades by you, you can turn your head. You don't have to look. And I'm suggesting this to you with all the love I have in my heart. People that dress that way, men and women, there's a reason for it. It's to get noticed. And you will get noticed. But that kind of notice you don't want. See, there's a danger in that. You know what the number one vice today is? It's not gambling, it's not drinking, and it's not drugs. It's pornography. Do you know it's a $4 billion industry? Tell me the devil doesn't know what he's doing. What's the remedy? You know what the remedy is? I'm just going to read one, Job. You know what Job said in Job 31:1? He said, I have made a covenant with my eyes not to sin against the Lord. What did Job mean? He's going to keep his eyes where they belong, and he's not going to let them stray into where they don't belong. And you know what? That's good advice. You see, lust of the eyes is something that comes from within us. It's by what we look at. It's by where we put ourselves. It's by where we place ourselves. And then we are tempted and enticed to sin. But I'm strong. I can take it. You want to risk your soul? You want to risk your soul? You want to risk everything that's good about your life? You want to take that risk? God says that's foolish. The last, pride of life, desire to make one wise. In Luke chapter 22, the apostles, you know, they had a problem with this. Luke 22, verse 24. Now there was also a dispute among them to which of them should be the greatest. Who's going to be the greatest apostle? Oh, I already know the answer to that. Jesus Christ is the greatest apostle. Read Hebrews chapter 8 and 9. He's the greatest apostle. But you see, there was competition between them. And God rebukes him. God said, rebukes him for that. Said, you're going to be a servant. There's not going to be any competition because you're all equal in my sight, because they're supposed to be servants to one another. There's no pride of life. There's no somebody's in a higher position. You know what? I'm a gospel preacher, and I'm up here a lot teaching and preaching, but you know, that doesn't make me any more significant than you. That doesn't make me more important in the Lord's church than you. You're as important as me. If you're a woman, you're a man, you've been young, you're old, you're in the middle, it doesn't matter. We're all important to God. I just have a different role. That doesn't make me more important. And when I allow my pride to think I'm more important, that the church can't get along without me, then I'm falling to sin. I'm going to fall into sin. Remember Haman? Oh, he couldn't stand Mordecai. Why didn't he like Mordecai? Because he wouldn't bow down to him. He wouldn't worship him. And so he wanted to get in that. He didn't just want to kill Haman. He wanted to kill all the Jews that were in Shushan. He wanted to kill every one of them that was in the citadel. That's how prideful Mordecai was. And he even built a gallows 50 feet in order to hang Haman, to hang him on it. Haman was going to hang Mordecai on that gallows. You know how God worked that out? Who hung on that gallows? It wasn't Mordecai. It was Haman. His pride got the best of him. You know what, brethren? We're insignificant. God doesn't need us. We need God. And I'm no more important than the next man. And it's not about me, and it's never been about me. And I got news for you, it's not about you either. It's never been about us. It's about God. It's about God's will. It's about God's word. It's about God's priority and what he wants us to do. It's always been about God. And whenever we begin to get too high and mighty, and whenever we get to think that nobody can get along without us, and that we're so great in what we do, we better take a step back and we better do some thinking. Because pride is going to get the best of you. What's the warning? Oh, the warning is very easy. Here's the solution. Solution we can see in Romans chapter 12, verse 16. Chapter 12, verse 16 says, be of the same mind one towards another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion. Don't get wrapped up in yourself, because you're bound to fall if you do. Pride of life. And so Eve was enticed in all three of these ways. When Jesus was tempted in Matthew chapter 4, he was tempted in all three of these ways. Now, here's the good news. The Lord had victory when he was tempted. He was tempted in all points like as us, yet without sin. You know, whenever we read that, I don't think we really give Jesus the credit. You know, I understand he was God in the flesh, but he wasn't tempted as God. He was tempted as a man. And he had the ability as a man to give in to the enticement and to the temptation, but he said no. He chose to follow his Father's will. He didn't give in to the enticement. And you know what he did that for? To show that we could do that too. That we don't have to say yes either. That we can say no just like he did. He was tempted in all ways, yet as us, yet without sin. As a man, he was tempted in every way. And what does that mean, in all ways of man? That means the lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. He was tempted in all three of those ways, and he said no to all of them. You know why? Because we have the ability to do the same. He was assailed while physically weak. He had been out there 40 days and 40 nights and not eaten or drunk. And Satan said, take these stones and make him bread. Now, did any of you in this audience deny that he couldn't have done that? The man that could give blind his sight? Man that raised Lazarus after 4 days? Man that walked on the water? He couldn't take simple stones and make him bread? Turn the water into wine? And he couldn't make, you know, I got a book in my library written by one of my brethren that say, well, he really wasn't hungry. What? He hadn't eaten for 40 days. We're hungry if we miss one meal. He hadn't eaten in 40 days. Was that a temptation? You know what? If that wasn't a temptation, then I don't know what was. That was a temptation. And you know what? Satan assails us when we're weak. Remember what I told you this morning? Satan doesn't care about what's going on in your life. He doesn't care about what you're troubled with. He doesn't care about what your circumstances. He doesn't care. All he wants you to do is sin and like it. So you do it again. That's all he wants. But you know why he was able to do it? You know why he was able to say no? Because he was centered. He was focused on doing his Father's will. He was not going to let anything distract him. He was going to do what his Father sent him to do. And every time Satan came calling, what did Jesus say? It is written. He focused on what was important. Now, why did he do that? You know why the Lord had victory over sin? To show that we can too if we follow that prescription. If we follow the same mindset he had, we will say no to sin more times than we will give in. Do you believe that? You should. That's why it's in there. So bringing all these lessons to a close that I've talked about Satan, I want you to know, first of all, that Satan is real. He's not imaginary. He exists. He's a real adversary, and do not underestimate him, and do not think that he does not want your soul, because he does. If not, who tempted Eve? If Satan is not real, who tempted Eve, and who tempted the Lord? Who did that? God didn't do it. Somebody did it. Who was it? Satan is our adversary. He's your enemy. He's your enemy. He wants your soul. He wants to destroy you spiritually. And he doesn't care how he goes about getting it done. And every door that you open, Satan's going to walk through it. Every opportunity you give him, he's going to take. He's never going to say no to an opportunity. He never do that. Because he's tenacious. And every time you let him walk in the door, he's going to take it. Satan is a tempter. Satan's going to tempt us to violate God's will. He's going to tempt us to go contrary to what God said. He's going to tempt us to go back into the world. He's going to tempt us to not be as diligent, not to be as committed, not to be as dedicated, not to be as spiritual minded as God tells us we need to be. He is going to tempt you and entice you to do that. Now let me ask you a question. Why did Jesus and the Father tell us that He would do that? Why did He show us the way that He would do that? Why did He tell us what His purpose is? Why did He tell us how He works? Why did He do that? Here's why He did it. So we can beat Him. So we can resist Him. I close this lesson with James 4, 7 and 8. This is a simple scripture. But this is the key to defeating your adversary. In James 4, 7 it says, therefore, submit to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. You have to resist the devil. But you cannot resist the devil until you first submit your life to God. God will give you the ability to say no to the devil. If my focus is on doing God's will, if my mind is on spirituality, if I am dedicated, if I am striving to live the life and walk in the straight and narrow path, and if my desire is to get to heaven, God will help me make sure that I get there. And He will show me how to resist the devil. You notice it didn't say that when he flees, he's going for good, did it? Didn't say that. You can resist the devil, but here's the bad news. You can say no to him today, he's going to come knocking on your door again tomorrow. And he's going to knock on it every tomorrow until you leave this life or until the world comes to an end. But the good news is he cannot make you stumble. He cannot make you sin. Just like God can't make you do what's right, the devil can't make you do what's wrong. He can set the trap. He can set the snare. He can entice you. He can tempt you. But he can't make you yield. He can't make you say yes. You have to do that. I have to do that. So God says, resist him. Satan's allurements. He wants to destroy us. Don't let him. He wants you to lose. Don't let him win. Fight him. Fight him and beat him at his own game. Put your mind to serve God. And pray God every day to help me not fall prey to Satan's tactics. And you know what? What does James 5:16 say? The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. God will help us, but he can't help us if we don't help ourselves. Please take your songbook out. The song has been selected tonight. I hope and pray that these lessons that I've dealt with Satan, I hope you understand that it's a real fight. It's something that's not imaginary. It's not something that's going away tomorrow or the next day or the next week. It's something you're going to have to contend with while you live here. But the good news is he only has success if you give in to him. And you have the ability to say no. If you're here and you're not a Christian, you have the ability to say no and come out of his world. You have the ability to say no to him and come out of his dominion, and come out of the dominion and the bondage of sin. And you can do that by rendering obedience to the gospel. By hearing the word of God, believing it, repenting of your sin, confessing his name before man, and submitting to baptism, contact the blood of Christ. And you can begin to walk down that straight and narrow path that leads to life. But as I said this morning, many of you have already done that. How are you doing in your fight with Satan? Are you up more than you're down, or are you down more than you're up? Does he win more than you like him to? Does he win far too many times and you wonder why? Here's the key, ladies and gentlemen. One of the keys to defeating Satan is, number one, don't underestimate. Number two, don't put yourself in playing by his rules. And number three, don't put yourself in his backyard. Because when you do, you're going to play by his rules. What's his backyard? this whole world. He's the prince of it. And if you play in his backyard, you're going to give him more opportunity to get you. Be smarter than that. Listen to God. Listen to his instruction. Follow them. They work. And he will protect you. Remember that passage I read to you earlier in this lesson? God's desire is that everyone be saved. But that's especially true for his children. And he's doing everything he can to help make sure that that happens in your life. But you got to help him. And how we help him is we listen to his instruction and we follow them. And if we follow them, they will work. Because God does not lie. We can help you tonight in any way. We bid you to come forward as together we stand.